content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 1st, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing has Robert Mueller. He's sitting at the end of a dock, legs dangling over the water. He's looking back over his shoulder with his typical sort of deadpan kind of look. He's got a fishing rod in his hand, and he's reeling it. It's doubled over. It looks like he's caught something. And in the water just beneath him, you can see a couple of shark fins sticking out of the water like they're prowling around. The title of the article is, or the title of the cover is, How's the Fishing? What We Know and Don't After 1 Year of Mueller's Russia Investigation. So I think we'll come to that later. But the first main story is also somewhat related. Trump's war with the Justice Department. What happened? President Trump this week escalated his attack on the Russia investigation, ordering the Justice Department to investigate whether the FBI's use of an informant to approach three campaign aides during the 2016 election was an improper, partisan-motivated effort to spy on his team. The use of the informant was revealed earlier this month by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, who subpoenaed the Justice Department for documents relating to the confidential source and other aspects of the Russia investigation. The department forcefully rejected this request, citing fears for the informant's safety. But when media outlets published further details about the source last week, the president announced on Twitter that I hereby demand a Justice Department investigation into whether the FBI infiltrated or surveilled his team, and whether Obama administration officials were involved. Spygate could be one of the biggest political scandals in history, Trump tweeted, warning the criminal deep state that what goes around comes around. In response, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced that the Justice Department Inspector General's existing inquiry into the genesis of the Russia investigation would be expanded to address Trump's concerns. In a subsequent meeting at the White House, Rosenstein and FBI Director Chris Wray agreed to share with Nunes and fellow Republican Representative Trey Gowdy certain documents Nunes requested, including a Rosenstein memo outlining the scope of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's authority. A White House spokeswoman said Democratic congressional leaders would not be shown the documents. The informant was identified by several news outlets as Stephen Halper, a retired UK-based American academic who was a foreign policy advisor in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations. In the summer of 2016, Halper reportedly approached three Trump officials, George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, and Sam Clovis, to assess whether the campaign was colluding with Russia. FBI sources said this step was taken only after the Bureau received evidence that Page had suspicious Kremlin contacts and that Papadopoulos had bragged that the Russians had stolen a trove of Democratic emails. What the editorial said: we have long feared Trump would trigger a constitutional crisis by shutting down the Mueller investigation, said the Los Angeles Times. His actions this week suggest he is ready to cross that threshold. If the president is willing to order the Justice Department to open investigations that serve him personally and politically, what's to stop him from demanding an end to an investigation he considers a political liability, said the Washington Post. Trump's claims are completely baseless, said the Washington Post. There is a big difference between embedding an FBI spy within a campaign and using an outside informant to gather information. Everything we have learned suggests that a counterintelligence investigation into Russian collusion was more than warranted in view of numerous secretive contacts between the campaign and Russians. If there are any grown-ups left in the leadership of the Republican Party, they need to stop this dangerous crisis of trust in law enforcement. All the president is asking for is transparency, said the New York Post. Lots of questions need answering. Why did the FBI Justice Department insist that identifying Halper would endanger his life if, as Axios.com has reported, Halper later lobbied for a job in the Trump administration? Was he still on the FBI payroll at the time? Law enforcement officials have done everything they can to avoid these and other questions. What do they fear? What the columnist said, Trump's claim of a nefarious deep state plot is unhinged, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. His defenders' working theory is that the FBI used their informant to set in motion an investigation that could serve as a fatal October surprise before the election. The tiny flaw in this theory? They never sprang the October surprise. Worried about tipping the scales, the FBI kept a tight lid on their investigation of Trump aides until after the election, while badly damaging Hillary Clinton with repeated public announcements about their investigation of her emails. Trump's critics always clamor for a full accounting of what transpired during 2016, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. Surely they should be happy that no stone is being left unturned and that supposedly maligned nonpartisan FBI officials will now have a chance to clear their names. Liberals cast any effort to look beyond Russian collusion as a distraction, said John Fund in NationalReview.com, but they used to be appalled at the abuses of power by the FBI, CIA, and other secretive government agencies, which have a long history of spying on people for illegitimate reasons. Can liberals not even consider that there might be two stories relating to 2016 campaign skullduggery rather than just one? We still don't know how far Trump will go to undermine the investigation into himself and his cronies, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. But he has repeatedly said he views law enforcement as an instrument of his political will and insisted that he has the absolute right to do what he wants with the Justice Department. So he has effectively told us he will do whatever he can get away with to stop this investigation. We should believe him. And our controversy of the week, trade. Did Trump whip out on China? Coming from the best-selling author of The Art of the Deal, the so-called trade deal President Trump struck last week with China sure didn't look too artful, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. Trump, a protectionist who sees trade deficits as the ultimate evil, has been threatening to slap tariffs worth up to $150 billion on Chinese imports as punishment for Chinese trade practices that Trump likened to rape. But when a Chinese delegation resisted his negotiators' demands at talks in Washington, Trump's tough talk evaporated, as it so often does. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the threatened trade war is now on hold. The self-proclaimed world's greatest negotiator came away with only a vague pledge from the Chinese to significantly increase their spending on U.S. goods, which China's expanding middle class is already doing. Trump's trade agenda is deeply confused, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. Mnuchin and Chief Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow are Wall Street free traders, while Trump Chief Trade Advisor Peter Navarro is a fierce anti-China protectionist. The Chinese exploited this division in the Washington talks, as well as Trump's desperation for China's help in his upcoming summit with North Korea. On Team USA, it's been amateur hour. The press is trying to paint this as an American defeat, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, because the Chinese rebuffed Trump's demand for a $200 billion reduction in the trade deficit. But that target was always arbitrary and fanciful. The good news is that the nations not only avoided a trade war, but also agreed that the way forward lies in opening China's market, not closing America's. Only time will tell if China will make good on its vague promises to buy more American goods and to respect U.S. intellectual property, said Stuart Eisenstadt in TheHill.com. But it seems clear that Trump's threats of tariffs got China's attention in a way that nicer overtures from previous presidents never did. Still, we need a more sophisticated approach, said Orrin Cass in NationalReview.com. Trump's monomaniacal focus on the U.S.-China trade deficit is like playing one-dimensional chess and does little to dismantle China's wider architecture of unfair trade and business practices. China firms compete with the full weight of China's government behind them and have been stealing U.S. intellectual property for years. The best way to curb those abuses would be in concert with other nations. But Trump foolishly withdrew the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have made such joint efforts possible. Trump's trade strategy has a fundamental flaw, said William Pesek in Politico.com. By trying to revive a fading U.S. manufacturing industry, the president is dragging America back to 1985, while China is rapidly developing an economy based on the future. Technology, artificial intelligence, robotics, and green energy. Trump may not understand economics, said Robert Kuttner in Prospect.org, but he has a keen nose for winning political symbolism. Blaming China and NAFTA as the real cause of American decline resonates with his base, even if it's economically irrational. Trump thinks that as long as he sounds like he's fighting for blue-collar workers and farmers, they'll stick with him. Trump almost certainly doesn't care about the details of trade policy, said Jeff Spross in TheWeek.com. That suggests he'll let his advisors tinker around the margins of the status quo with both China and NAFTA, and then declare victory. The winners of that strategy will be China, Wall Street, most U.S. corporations, and good old-fashioned republic economic orthodoxy. And it is time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for miracles. After two women in a Lexus SUV survived a 300-foot plunge off a cliff in California. The vehicle cartwheeled down the cliff, then landed atop a rock in the deep Russian River, enabling the occupants to scramble to safety. It was a good week for fine motor control after 600 German firefighters attended a mechanical failure seminar on the safe removal of rings, plugs, bottles, and other objects from the private parts of fetishists who run into difficulties. The training is not fun for us, said firefighter Matthias Legnick. And it was a good week for trolling when Hillary Clinton whipped out a traditional Russian Ushanka hat during an address to students at Yale University. I mean, if you can't beat them, join them, Clinton told the cheering crowd, adding, no, I'm not over it. But it was a bad week for Lotharios, with the passing of a new French law under which men can be fined up to $880 if they whistle at or make lewd comments to women in the street. It was a bad week for renunciation after a Buddhist monk in Japan sued his monastery for making him work too many hours. Monks have long been expected to endure hardship on the road to enlightenment, the plaintiff's lawyer acknowledged, but such a notion is outdated. And finally, it was a bad week for basement dwellers after New York State Supreme Court ordered a 30-year-old man to move out of his parents' home. Michael Rotondo, age 30, had ignored multiple eviction notices from his parents, as well as their friendly advice. There are jobs available even for those with a poor work history like you. Get one. And before we leave this page, we'll read a boring but important item. Trump pushes higher postal rates for Amazon. President Trump has urged the U.S. Postal Service to double the rates it charges Amazon to deliver packages, the Washington Post reported. Trump has met with U.S. Postmaster General Megan Brennan at the White House several times since the beginning of 2017 to push for higher rates, according to administration sources. Brennan has repeatedly pushed back against the president's demands, explaining that current arrangements with Amazon and other companies are not only profitable for the Postal Service, but also bound by contracts and subject to regulatory review. Trump believes that Amazon is being unfairly subsidized by the Postal Service and has lashed out on Twitter at Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post. On the briefing page, we have the teachers' revolt. Public school teachers are striking for better pay and increased funding for their classroom. Are they winning? Where are teachers striking? Public school teachers have mounted statewide walkouts in six states since the beginning of the year, thronging state capitals with demonstrations to demand better pay and increased funding for their classrooms. The wave of strikes began on February 22nd in West Virginia, which in 2016 ranked 48th in the country for teacher pay, with an average annual salary of $45,622. Roughly 20,000 teachers walked off the job for 9 workdays, closing schools statewide until the legislature passed a 5% raise for all state workers. Since then, there have been walkouts in Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, Colorado, and North Carolina. These places are saying, we know that if they've done it in West Virginia, we can do it here too, said Annette Jordan, a teacher at Hedgesville High School in West Virginia. Why these states? Almost all of the protests have been in states where Republican-dominated governments have dramatically cut education budgets over the past decade. Many states slashed school funding as tax receipts dwindled in the aftermath of the financial crisis and didn't fully restore it when the economy recovered. Tax cuts passed by GOP-dominated legislatures have also cut deeply into education funding. Arizona, where per-student funding has fallen 13.6% since 2008, slashed corporate tax rates in 2011 by 30%. Oklahoma, which has seen multiple rounds of tax cuts beginning in the mid-2000s, has reduced per-student funding by 28% since the start of the recession. Educators there just won their first raise in 10 years. How have cuts impacted teachers? They've been devastating. A recent NPR survey of more than 500 teachers found that 59% work a second job to make ends meet, while more than 8 in 10 had bought school supplies with their own money to be able to do their jobs. Christina Johnson, an Oklahoma teacher who is paid $44,000 a year despite several degrees and 20 years' experience, says she and her students must contend with 15-year-old textbooks, wasps living in the ceiling, broken desks, and leaky ceilings. Like many teachers, she works multiple jobs to get by. Catherine Vaughn, a teacher with a master's degree and 11 years of experience, who makes $50,000 a year in Tennessee, has a $100 annual budget to buy art supplies for 800 students. Some schools have been forced to switch to four-day weeks just to save money. We have districts that are choosing between the light bill and toilet paper, said Mark Jewell, head of the North Carolina Association of Educators. That's not normal. Have the strikes succeeded? Teachers have won pay raises and some funding increases, but say their grievances have not been fully addressed. Oklahoma passed its first tax hike in 28 years to raise $450 million in the new education funding. But legislators balked at reinstating a capital gains tax demanded by the teachers' union. Instead, the state passed new taxes on cigarettes, oil, and gas, which some have complained will hurt the poor more than the wealthy. In Arizona, teacher pay will be raised 20% by 2020, but the legislature has refused to restore school funding to pre-recession levels. The state also hasn't provided a realistic plan for paying for the raises, and some teachers fear that the money will come out of other parts of the state budget, such as Medicaid and other social services funding. What does the public think? Voters overwhelmingly support the teachers' demands. A recent poll found that 90% of Democrats, 78% of independents, and 66% of Republicans think teachers aren't paid enough. Half of Americans said they were willing to pay more in taxes to raise teacher pay and increase school funding. But some conservatives have pushed back at the idea that teachers are underpaid, saying they get summers off and substantial pensions, which most private sector workers do not. I don't believe they're undercompensated at all, said Andrew Biggs, who studies retirement issues at the American Enterprise Institute. Teacher pensions are a lot more expensive, and they're a lot more generous than people think they are. What's next? Teacher pay is becoming an issue nationwide. Although teachers are relatively well paid in higher tax states such as California and New York, the average national teacher salary decreased 4% between 2008 and 2017 when adjusted for inflation. The overall pay gap between educators and private sector workers is growing. Today, teachers make from 60 to 80% of what similarly educated workers do in the private sector, depending on the state. Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist at the University of California, Berkeley, worries that these really huge pay gaps inevitably will erode the quality of the education schools provide America's children. We have to think about students that are in college now that are trying to determine what professions they're going to go into, Allegretto says. Are the best and brightest going to continue to go into teaching with this scenario? And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with one from the U.S. from Sophie Gilbert at TheAtlantic.com, titled, A Royal Like We've Never Seen. Why were so many Americans fascinated by the royal wedding? Asked Sophie Gilbert. More than 29 million got up early on a Saturday to watch Meghan Markle marry Prince Harry in a ceremony that plunged the royal family into the 21st century. Markle, of course, is the old dream come true, fulfilling the fantasy of an ordinary mortal being thrust into royalty. one that's been played out in countless fairy tales from Cinderella to the Princess Diaries. And she's biracial, divorced, 36-year-old American feminist. Hardly your stereotypical princess. The feverish coverage of every American TV network and the large audience it generated suggests that Americans are almost more infatuated with the idea of inherited privilege than the British are. But Markle is already shaking up an institution that has doggedly resisted change. The spirited wedding sermon from U.S. Episcopal Bishop Michael Curry confronted the legacy of slavery and quoted Martin Luther King. A largely African-American choir sang a soulful version of Stand By Me. Millions may have tuned in because of fascination with royal tradition, but what we witnessed was the redefinition of the word princess. It's an interesting title from the Netherlands. Enough with boozy bike tours. Amsterdam is reclaiming its streets from the tourists, says Lisa Vandervelden last week. The new four-party coalition municipal government, which can agree on little else, announced drastic measures to curb overcrowding and drunken rowdiness in the city center. The cruise ship terminal, which disgorges thousands of tourists at a time, will be relocated far outside the city, and canal boat tours will now start on the outskirts, not downtown. Party transportation, including multi-person beer bikes, which require passengers to pedal as they drink, but come with a sober driver, and hot tugs or floating hot tubs, will be limited, as well as those annoying Segway tours. And officials will crack down on kitschy tourist shops that sell substandard shrink-wrapped cheese and Nutella products. These stern measures are overdue. Amsterdam has only 850,000 residents, but hosts some 18 million visitors a year. And that number is expected to shoot up to 25 million by 2025. The city used to be able to cap tourism by limiting hotel construction, but the rise of Airbnb has turned every apartment into a potential guest house. That's why the new restrictions will also slash allowed sublet days through Airbnb-like services from 60 to 30 a year, and down to zero in some neighborhoods. Amsterdam needs to be a livable city first, and a tourist destination only second. And from Russia, how long will we accept stagnation? Our eternal president has trapped Russia in a time warp, said Nikita Isayev. After being sworn in for a fourth term in office earlier this month, Vladimir Putin called on the country to strive for new breakthroughs to improve living standards. But how can that happen with no new blood at the top? Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, who compliantly switched places with Putin for a single term in 2008 to get around term limits, remains in his post. First Deputy Prime Minister Anton Silanov will again be in charge of economic policy. Nearly all the faces in the cabinet, in fact, are the same. Nor has Putin offered a single fresh policy idea. This is stagnation that will hold back the technological, scientific, industrial, and social development of the country. We're seeing Soviet-style lauding of achievements where no progress was actually made. Look at Putin's 2012 promise to raise the salaries of public sector workers by up to 50% by 2018. Those who received raises were either moved to part-time work, so they got the same pay just for fewer hours, or saw their bonuses cut. For many, this supposed wage increase led ultimately to a reduction in income. Without real economic reform, I give this government about a year until Russia has a social explosion. The Last Word article this week is titled, A Dad, A Daughter, and Guns. In conservative Wyoming, firearms are part of the fabric of everyday life, said journalist Eli Saslow. So when one teen, upset about school shootings, began to call for gun control, the resistance began at home. Gillette, Wyoming. Alan Engdahl was driving home after an overnight shift in the oil field when his truck picked up a scratchy radio signal out of Gillette. It was the first sign of civilization since he had disappeared the afternoon before down 50 miles of wind-whipped prairie and rutted gravel roads. So Alan and his co-worker listened to the disc jockey tick through community news. Cattle prices were flat. TNT guns had antique rifles on special. The cowboy draw lotto was up to $1 million. And here's something you don't hear every day, the radio host said. We apparently have a liberal gun protest happening right here in Gillette. Alan had rarely heard anything described as liberal in northeast Wyoming, and now he listened as the DJ explained how 10 Campbell County high school students had marched downtown the previous afternoon to demand tighter gun laws. They said they wanted mandatory background checks on all gun purchases. They said they wanted to build a gun control movement in solidarity with the survivors of a shooting in Parkland, Florida. But this was Wyoming, where the high school yearbook devoted 4 pages to hunting, no greater sport, and a local club funded college scholarships by raffling off AR-15s. The protesters had been met downtown with middle fingers and the warning of suspensions. They should be expelled, Alan remembered joking to his co-worker. That bleeding heart nonsense might fly in New York or D.C., but in Wyoming, that's treason. Wyoming has more guns per capita than any other state, and more than 80% of adults in Campbell County have firearms in their homes. Alan once owned more than 250 until he committed a drug felony in 2006 and lost his legal right to own guns. He parked at a ramshackle house on the outskirts of town where the newspaper waited at the kitchen table. On the front page, he noticed a story about the gun protest, the first that anyone could remember in Gillette. A walkout for change, the headline read. Above that was a picture of several students marching, and there in the midst of them, holding a protest sign, was his 16-year-old daughter, Mariah. Now, a week later, that sign was in his house, tucked into the closet of a bedroom where Mariah had been spending much of her time, with her door closed since the protest. In the days since the march, the Campbell County 10 had become the object of profane graffiti and the favorite target of a new Instagram account, Campbell County Students for America, which shared memes comparing gun protesters to Hitler. For his part, Alan had considered grounding Mariah for skipping school, but decided against it. I'm pretty sure the rest of Wyoming is going to punish her for me, he said. So instead, he had chosen to needle Mariah at every opportunity. Win any popularity contests at school today, he asked when she walked into the kitchen. She rolled her eyes and ignored him, so he tried again. Did you manage to get everyone's guns yet? He said. How many times do I have to tell you it's not about that, she said. We're just pushing for more safety, a little more control. That's a bad word, Alan said. First it's gun control, then it's confiscation. She was the youngest of his 4 daughters, each a bit more empowered than the last. And by the time Mariah turned 12, she had begun questioning her parents' Christianity and then started favoring abortion rights and then calling herself a feminist, and then refusing to eat the pigs her family sometimes slaughtered for meat. The mouthy, hard-headed one, Alan called her, with some pride, even if they often disagreed. She advocated for gay rights in her high school, and he thought acceptance was part of the problem because that stuff is better off staying hidden. She was dating a Mexican-American boy named John, whom Allen liked but also occasionally referred to as Mexican Juan. But one thing they had rarely argued about was guns, at least until 17 people were killed at a high school in Parkland in February. Mariah occasionally went target shooting at the range on Ladies' Day with her mother, who was remarried and living across town. Her mother's freezer was filled with fresh venison from her latest October kill. Her father and his friends had sometimes fired off 1,500 rounds a day of target shooting before he went to prison for distribution of methamphetamines. Like her parents, Mariah had usually blamed Gillette's high rates of gun violence not on firearms, but on the character of the town itself. The coal and oil boom town had nearly doubled in size since the 1990s to about 32,000 people, many of whom worked to extract the natural resources below ground. The town suffered from high rates of transiency and wild economic swings, which contributed to one of the country's highest suicide rates. After Parkland, though, Mariah began reading online about guns and became interested in research suggesting that guns are part of the mental health crisis, too. She read that suicides account for almost two-thirds of gun deaths, and that people are five times more likely to successfully commit suicide if they own or have access to a gun. Her cousin had killed himself with a hunting rifle in 2015. One of her classmates had brought a gun to school a year later, sparking an evacuation before he shot and killed himself by the railroad tracks. She lived with her father in a single-story place wedged between a cow pasture and a coal mine. A dartboard hung in the kitchen, and red plastic cups filled the cabinets. Her father styled himself as gruff and imposing, but he was also a big-hearted savior of damaged cars and lost people, both of which populated his 5 acres. There was Luke, who had nowhere to live until Allen offered up his shed, and a drifter called himself Tennessee, who had come to Wyoming looking for work, but failed a background check, and Scotty, who spent his days trying to fix some of the 17 trucks surrounding the house. Sweet but crazy uncles, Mariah called them, because they were almost always following Allen's lead, whether that meant watching old westerns or teasing Mariah. "You know why I like guns, Mariah?" Tennessee said now. "Because otherwise we'd be under British rule." "You're all stuck in an old way of thinking," Mariah said. "You guys have no idea how many people are with us." The truth was that she didn't exactly know either, so later that week, the Campbell County 10 scheduled a meeting after school for anyone open to gun solutions. Mariah met a few friends in the school's parking lot, and they walked to Starbucks. Their original protest march had begun with 10 students, but dropped quickly to 9 when an irate parent drove downtown and yanked her daughter into the car. In the days since, a few more students had dropped out of the group's text messaging chain after saying they wanted to focus on less controversial issues, like remembering victims or discouraging bullying. Now there were 5 of them, including one who opened the meeting by reminding everyone that she was not officially in the group and that her parents were trying to get her a job at a shooting range. "I'm just here to watch," she said. That meant the Campbell County 10 was in fact down to Mariah and 3 others, a freshman wearing a Pink Floyd t-shirt, a senior who described herself as fiercely, fiercely liberal, and the outspoken editor of the school newspaper. Mariah tried to take notes as everyone spoke at once about starting a group Instagram account, or writing to Wyoming senators, or boycotting Walmart until it stopped selling rifles. "It's like there's a gun addiction here," one girl said. "Even my dad has started calling me a gun control libtard," said another. "Quieter, please," Mariah said, because the woman at the next table had set down her newspaper and was openly staring and scowling in their direction. Mariah leaned in and spoke just above a whisper. "We need to be completely angerless, or else people will think we want to take away their guns and melt them into a statue of Obama. We need to focus on one thing." Mariah suggested her preference for what that should be, keeping guns out of Campbell County High. The school board in another Wyoming county had just voted to arm its teachers with concealed handguns after a survey showed 74% of residents supported that idea. Campbell County School Board had begun meeting with law enforcement to explore a similar possibility. The next school board meeting was just a few days away. Each meeting was open to public comments. One message, Mariah said again, but now a few other customers had begun to gawk at their table, and some of the girls stood up to pack their bags. "Are we going to do this?" Mariah asked, and when there was no definitive answer, she started packing too. She bought a new dress and borrowed her sister's best lip gloss. She trimmed her speech to the recommended 3-minute allotment, double-checked her statistics, and practiced 6 times in the living room. Then she went to a nondescript county building and waited her turn to speak until the chairwoman called her up to a seat at the center of the room. "Thank you for your time, trusted board members," Mariah said. She smiled up at 12 school administrators seated on an elevated platform and then began to read from a speech that was now shaking in her hands. "I'm here to express my concerns about arming teachers," she said. "I believe allowing firearms in schools is an irrational idea to introduce here." She told the school board that she was worried about the mental health epidemic in Gillette and that some school employees inevitably suffered from those problems, too. She said that teachers were not trained for shootouts and that even armed school security guards had failed to stop shootings. "Adding more guns to the equation will not be a universal solution," she said, and now her 3 minutes were almost up. She asked the board to search for new ways and then concluded by smiling and thanking them again. The chairwoman grabbed her mic and told Mariah that she wanted to set her mind at ease. She said the district was looking into many ways to ensure student safety, including bulletproof glass, door jamming devices, and possibly guns. "It will be a long and careful process," she said, and then she moved on to the next speaker. Mariah retreated to the back of the room near her mother, her boyfriend, and 2 of her sisters as the school board rolled through its agenda, until it began to feel to Mariah as if her speech had all but evaporated. "You did great," her mother said once they left, "measured and respectful." "But did they get it?" Mariah asked. "I feel like maybe they heard but didn't exactly listen." She went back to her father's house where everyone was sitting in the kitchen. "How'd the gun controlling go?" Alan asked, and Mariah started to tell him about the meeting until he cut in. "I guess it really doesn't matter if they have guns or not," Alan said. "If one of those shootings happened in Wyoming, you'd have parents breaking through the windows with more guns than you'd ever seen." "Okay," she said, "but that's my point. I'm trying to." "If you got a gun, then just bring it," Tennessee interrupted. "I don't see why we need much regulation myself." "They are trying to push toward confiscation," Luke said. "First it's control," Alan said. Mariah sat there as they talked over her, circling the same points. She was trying to be patient. She was trying to compromise. "Hey, I'm trying to say something," she said. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The, quote, "new journalist who gleefully skewered the elite." Tom Wolfe, 1930 to 2018. Tom Wolfe sparked a literary movement almost by accident. Commissioned to write about California's custom car scene for Esquire in 1963, the then little-known reporter found himself nearing deadline with stacks of material and a bad case of writer's block. His editor told Wolfe to type up his notes, which he then fashioned into an article, and Wolfe dutifully bashed out 49 pages in an all-nighter. But the editor was blown away by Wolfe's verbal dexterity and sharp observations and printed the notes virtually untouched. That story, "There goes, vroom vroom, that candy-colored tangerine flake streamlined baby," marked the beginning of new journalism, the freewheeling, eccentrically punctuated, highly personal style of reportage that would be soon championed by writers like Hunter S. Thompson and Joan Didion. Wolfe would remain the movement's leading light, turning his travels aboard Ken Kesey's LSD bus in 1968's best-selling The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and telling the epic story of the first U.S. astronauts in 1979's The Right Stuff. While Wolfe would eventually become a novelist, writing the sprawling 1980s satire The Bonfire of the Vanities, he always believed journalism held a key advantage over fiction. The simple fact that the reader knows all this actually happened. Born in Richmond, Virginia, Wolfe was the son of an agronomist father and a homemaker mother, said the Washington Post. At age 9, he tried to write a biography of Napoleon. His dissertation at Yale's graduate school was initially rejected in part because of its attention-getting style. After starting his journalism career at Springfield, Massachusetts Union News, Wolfe joined the New York Herald Tribune in 1962 and found his voice as a social chronicler, said the New York Times. Charting the city's status wars, he became one of the paper's stars and began writing long-form magazine features. He specialized in lacerating the pretentiousness of others. In June 1970, New York Magazine dedicated an entire issue to Radical Chic, Wolfe's 20,000-word account of a Black Panthers fundraiser hosted by wealthy Manhattan liberals. "Do panthers like little Roquefort cheese morsels rolled on crusted nuts this way?" he mused. Wolfe's love of pricking sacred cows was matched only by his fondness for distinctive clothing, said the Wall Street Journal. Invariably dressed in a three-piece cream-colored suit with a brightly colored tie and a pocket square, Wolfe said his neo-pretentious outfit was vital to his job. "If people see that you are an outsider, they will come up and tell you things." His dandyish appearance belied a relentless work ethic. Wolfe spent months or years gathering material and forced himself to write 10 pages every day. "If it takes me 12 hours, that's too bad," he said. "I've got to do it." Having previously attacked contemporary novelists for their limited ambitions, Wolfe decided to try the form himself, said the Los Angeles Times. The Bonfire of the Vanities, published in 1987, was a stunning success. The story of a Wall Street trader and self-described master of the universe brought low, the novel encapsulated the greedy excesses and racial tensions of 1980s New York City. Flush with success, Wolfe issued a cri de coeur to his fellow writers, urging them to reclaim the American novel from the country's navel-gazing literary elite. His remarks didn't go down well. When Wolfe's second novel, A Man in Full, was published in 1998, Norman Mailer compared reading the 742-page tale of Atlanta's nouveau riche to making love to a 300-pound woman. Fall in love or be asphyxiated. Wolfe dismissed his novelist critics in scathing fashion. "It must gall them a bit that everyone, even them, is talking about me," he said. The returns on Wolfe's books continued to diminish, said the Times UK. His third and fourth novels, 2004's I Am Charlotte Simmons and 2012's Back to Blood, both fared badly. But Wolfe never lost his confidence in the power of his words. "I regard myself in the first flight of writers, but I don't dwell on this," he once said. "If anything, I think I tend to be a little modest." We're on the Talking Points page now, and circling back to that cover drawing with the article, The Russia Investigation, The Fishing Expedition Turns One. It's been 1 year since former FBI Director Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel for the Russia investigation, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Or as President Trump calls it, the greatest witch hunt in American history. The information that has come to light thus far presents an alarming picture of Russian outreach to the floundering Trump campaign, with at least 75 contacts and 22 meetings between Trump's team and individuals linked to Russia, and of repeated efforts by Trump to interfere with the investigation. Despite Trump's constant claims of no collusion and no obstruction, Mueller has secured the indictments of 19 individuals and three companies, as well as five guilty pleas. Meanwhile, the White House has gone from denying that the campaign had any communication whatsoever with Russia to admitting that discussions took place but weren't meaningful. Mueller's investigation is no fishing expedition, said Natasha Bertrand in TheAtlantic.com. We know that top Trump campaign officials met with Russians offering dirt on Hillary Clinton, that campaign manager Paul Manafort received millions from Russian oligarchs, that son-in-law Jared Kushner proposed a secret back-channel line of communication between the Trump team and the Russian government, and that Trump tried to lift U.S. sanctions on Russia just days after taking office, just as Vladimir Putin wanted. Nearly every week, troubling new revelations emerge, and there's no sign Mueller's investigation is winding down. So far, there's also no evidence of collusion, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Mueller's team has snagged some big fish in indicting Manafort for bank fraud and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn for lying to the FBI, but no one has been charged with or pleaded guilty to any crime that involved collusion or conspiracy with Russia. The public is tiring of Mueller's open-ended probe, said Liz Peek in FoxNews.com. One recent poll showed that 54% of voters support continuing the investigation, down from 60% in March. The year is up, Special Counsel Mueller. Time to show your cards or call it a day. Many of my fellow conservatives are in denial, said David French in NationalReview.com. Trump's defenders argue that there is no there, but the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee just declared otherwise. Its members said there was no reason to dispute the intelligence community's finding that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election to help President Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. Some of what we know about the Trump campaign's many meetings with Russians is ominous, including Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos being told in advance that Russians had stolen thousands of Democratic emails that would hurt Clinton when released. It's Mueller's job to connect the dots, and the American public deserves to see the full picture. At this point, the collusion question goes way beyond Russia, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was recently revealed that Trump Jr. and top Trump aide Stephen Miller met with George Nader, a longtime emissary for the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, shortly after Trump sewed up the Republican presidential nomination. Nader said that the Saudis and the UAE were eager to see Trump win the election and offered millions of dollars in covert assistance, which would be a crime. Some key elements, exactly who was behind the plan and what parts, if any, were carried out, remain murky. But we do know that Trump has dramatically shifted American foreign policy to align with the wishes of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, such as backing their blockade of U.S. ally Qatar. Did the Trump family sell U.S. foreign policy to the highest bidder? This, too, is part of the Mueller investigation. For Trump's defenders to say Mueller has presented no public proof of collusion is absurd, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The Republican former FBI head doesn't leak, so what Mueller has found can only be guessed at. But from everything we've seen so far, he has plenty to work with. Don't expect the investigation to end soon, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. The Iran-Contra and Whitewater probes lasted nearly 7 years, while congressional Republicans investigated the Benghazi attack for 28 months, coming up with nothing. By comparison, Mueller's investigation has been extremely fruitful and efficient. The scale and importance of what he has to dig through is monumental, including the Trump campaign's possible cooperation with a hostile foreign power, Trump's hidden financial ties to Russia, presidential obstruction of justice, and Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's Trump Tower-sized pile of potential crimes. So no, the Mueller investigation hasn't gone on too long. And that leaves us just enough time for a couple of short notes. We'll start with the number of babies born to American women dropped to a 30-year low in 2016 with 3.85 million births, according to a new federal statistics. With growing numbers of women delaying childbirth into their 30s or foregoing it altogether, the general fertility rate for women ages 15 to 44 was 60.2 births per 1,000 women, the lowest rate since the government began tracking more than a century ago. More people have been killed at American schools this year than have been killed while deployed in the U.S. military. There are 169 potentially active volcanoes in the country, according to the United States Geological Survey. About 50 volcanoes located in six states, Hawaii, Alaska, California, Oregon, and Washington, and Wyoming, are rated high priority or highest priority for monitoring for potential eruptions. Mount St. Helens in Washington is considered the most likely volcano to erupt again. And we will finish out the show today with a quote. This from Tom Wolfe, who we read the obituary for. He says, "An intellectual is a person knowledgeable in one field who speaks out only in others." And we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.